What are the things that your company may be doing today that actually makes it difficult for your customers to love you? When you remove those barriers and start to put in the right signals that inspire that customer love, your business can absolutely explode. And there's so many, many case studies. And I've done many blog posts on this, and there's stuff in my book about it. So many case studies. And when you look at all the case studies, it becomes more obvious that this is so critical. And so part of my mission in the world and communicating is just to get people to think more about this idea of emotion and love as a hard-nosed business topic, because it really is.
Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, wherever you are in the world. This is the Digital Supply Chain Podcast, the number one podcast focusing on the digitization of supply chain. And I'm your host, Global Vice President at SAP, Tom Raftery.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Digital Supply Chain Podcast. My name is Tom Raftery with SAP. And with me on the show today, I have my special guest, Howard. Howard, would you like to introduce yourself?
Oh, absolutely, Tom. Thank you so much for having me. Hey, everyone. I'm Howard Tiersky. I live here in Mahwah, New Jersey, just outside New York City, and with my five kids who've all been cooped up for coronavirus. So they're basically going crazy at this point. And my passion is working with large brands on helping them with digital transformation. It's such an interesting time we live in. The world is changing faster than ever, and companies have to keep up to stay relevant. And that's what I do all day, every day.
Superb, superb. How old are your kids?
My oldest is 19.
Okay.
She's actually heading back to college in a couple of weeks now, again, for the next term. But they range all the way down to 8. My youngest is 8. He's in second grade.
Wow. Wow. Tough time for kids. Anyway, we'll move on to actual podcast relevant topics, because people are tuning into this to hear about digital stuff. Kids are nice, but they don't pay the bills. Quite the opposite. So,
but they're my digital focus group about the next generation.
Oh, very good.
I get to see what the next generation of consumers are really going to be like.
Perfect. Perfect. Nice. Now, you've just written a book, Howard. It's just been published. It's called Winning Digital Customers. Can you tell me some of the reasons why you thought it was important to write this book?
Sure. Well, I've had an amazing perspective and opportunity for the last couple of decades working with so many large brands around the world and trying to figure this stuff out, because it wasn't obvious, and digital keeps changing, and there's all kinds of challenges to try to help large brands and undergo the transformation necessary to be successful in this digital world. And so I work with a certain number of companies every year, but I really felt like, gosh, my team and I have picked up so many hard-fought lessons along the way that it was really time to write them down and share it more broadly.
Okay. And I mean, just leafing through the book there, you've got a whole slew of, references on the inside pages from, organizations like the NFL, Michelle McKenna saying Howard Tiersky has been one of my secret weapons, and so on. Did you write all those yourself? And just, they're amazingly positive.
Mostly no, but I have to admit that there were a few people where I said, hey, I'd really love your endorsement. And they would say, can you just write something and I'll approve it? So I did write a couple of them, but I'll never tell you which one. But I didn't write that. I would never write that. Some of the stuff Michelle wrote, I'm like, Michelle, isn't that a little over the top? And she's like, no, that's how I feel. And I'm like, all right, well, thanks.
Brilliant. So what are some of the hard fought lessons that people can take from this book? Don't give them all away, because then they won't buy the book.
Oh, sure. Well, you know what? I'm happy to give them all away. I tell you, I publish so many videos and articles. I sometimes feel people must be tired of hearing from me. So I feel like I'm on a mission sometimes. So buy the book or just read all the stuff. It's all good to me. Look, the number one most important lesson is that the answers can all be found in your customer. It's all about driving customer behavior. To me, that's so much of what business is. And if you include in that driving your employees' behavior, you're probably at 90% of what makes a business successful. So if we think about our role in running a business is really influencing human behavior, then there's many things we need to do that successfully. But the number one thing is to make sure that we understand the people that we're trying to influence, because good luck doing that if you're just guessing. And so about, 20% of the book perhaps is my very best information on the specific methods to use to do customer research and really understand what pain is your customer in right now? What are their hopes and dreams, and what are their expectations, and how have those expectations changed? Even before you start to figure out what should we do, how should we change, what new features should we add, what new blog should we start or podcast or whatever, start by understanding what problems your customer is trying to solve. Because if you can effectively give them solutions to problems they don't have solutions to, or better solutions to problems that they're already trying to solve in some other way, you know, you're so far ahead of the game. And I find so many organizations don't do that, or either don't do it as much as they should, or don't give the insights they gain the respect or the socialization or the sharing around the organization that they could. And that if they did, they would be able to much more accurately aim their efforts.
Okay. And how do you find out what problems your customers have?
You know, there are a lot of different techniques. One of the ones that I use is ethnography or observational research. And so just as an example, we like to listen in on calls in call centers, hang out, mystery shop, go to stores or stadiums, or obviously different businesses have different places you go. But just as a few examples, my team spent time, we redid the roadside experience for AAA, American Automobile Association.
Sure.
And so we spent time riding in tow trucks, you know, to see when the tow truck driver arrives, what is the experience for the customer like? What questions are they asking? What challenges do they have? And also the driver, because we were working not only on improving the customer's experience, but figuring out, you know, what's taking the driver longer than necessary to get there? What could we do to empower that driver with better digital tools to make their experience smoother and make them better, both happier as a driver, but also better able to serve the customer? When I've spent time in sports stadiums, just watching and observing, and my team has, how do people get from the parking lot to the gate? How do they go through the ticketing process? How are they looking for food? How are they finding their seats? How are they getting information they need during a game? And you could do the same thing. And by the way, this is equally true for B2B. We spend time, for example, I don't know, so many projects, but like one of the ones we're working on right now is for ADP, which is the largest payroll processing company in the United States, working on the amazing next generation of the interfaces for payroll people who are, you know, giving us all our paychecks, right? We want them to have a good experience, right? We don't want those paychecks to be delayed. So how do you observe and understand if someone's doing that work, they have to make sure everyone's paychecks are right. What is their process like? What information do they need? What tools do they need? And how can we make that process better so it's faster, so it's less error prone? Just observing. And it sounds simple, but very often from just observing, you get amazing insights. And then there's many other techniques. Sometimes you do that with a number of people, and then you have to try to quantify. You say, well, I've observed 15 people, 3 of them are having this problem. I'm not sure if that's really, you know, 20%. It may be, but it may just be, you know, the small sample size that's skewing it. So then you go to more quantitative techniques like surveys and other things. So, and there's so many, I talk about a great number of different research techniques. Another is looking at data, you know, understanding, one of the problems that I go into detail in the book about is something we have special scripts and algorithms we use to look at customer data from, for example, digital interactions. And one of the things that we like to look for is something we call circular errors. And a circular error is just when you keep doing the same thing over and over. Have you done this? You go to a page, and here's what the server sees. The server sees Tom went to this page and he entered his email, but it was not a valid email. And so I gave him an error. So he entered the same email again, and I gave him that error again. And then he entered that same email a third time. What is wrong with Tom? And I gave him the same error again. Well, I don't need to be observing Tom to know this guy is probably either confused or frustrated.
Or
it could be because he's typing his email wrong, but it could be because there's a problem on our system, because you have an email like mine. My company is From Digital, and our email address end in from.digital. And probably 20% of websites just tell me that my email is invalid, and it is not.
Right.
But, and that's just one minor example. But so anytime you see these kinds of error patterns, but you have to look for them, right? You have to have some kind of code that's scouring for this pattern occurring, someone doing the same thing over and over and continuing to get errors. Something's wrong, right? Either your instructions are confusing, and so the user is making the same error over and over, not understanding it, or your system is bad and actually the user is correct and you're incorrectly giving them an error. Anyway, just so those are just a few examples. There are so many of ways to start to look for that pain.
Okay. And having found problems that, you know, are out there, what kind of digital transformation stories are you seeing amongst your clients?
We'll be right back.
Elevate your brand with the Sustainable Supply Chain Podcast, the exclusive voice in supply chain sustainability. Last year, this podcast's episode were downloaded 113,000 times by senior executives across the world, with listeners concentrated in the EU, North America, and Asia. Become a sponsor. Lead the conversation. Contact me for sponsorship opportunities and turn downloads into dialogues. Act today. Influence the future.
Oh, I mean, so many. And, you know, small and large, right? For example, we've worked with the Avis Budget Group for years on improving the car rental experience. And now, you know, you can see by going through and observing the challenges and roadblocks people hit. And it's not just about Avis, right? You could observe the same things about any travel website and going, oh, how can we make that a little better? How can we, people are getting tripped up on the date picker. Right? They're clicking the date picker and there's a problem. Let's fix that little problem. People are, they're confused by the way we present the vehicle information, or they don't understand the way the prices are laid out, whatever it is. And you fix all these little things. And then all of a sudden you've got millions and millions and millions of dollars of incremental revenue, because every one of those things might've improved your conversion by 0.1%, which doesn't sound like a lot, but when your site's doing $1 billion of revenue, you know, 0.1% is many millions of dollars. And then if you can find 10 things like that and you can improve 1%, I mean, that those couple of percentage points can be an enormous, enormous difference. So, you know, in other cases, it's something transformational. It's a whole new product. You know, one example is we work with Universal Studios theme parks. And one of the things that came out of the customer research that we did historically, and theme parks have a lot of proprietary merchandise. You go there and there's stuff you can buy, souvenirs that you can't buy it, like the toy store near you. It's specific to the theme park. And there's a historical mindset about theme parks that, well, that's one of the reasons that that's sort of a draw of a theme park. We have all this unique merchandise. But what we learned from the research is that a lot of people, they want to buy more stuff. They don't buy as much stuff as they'd like to, either because they don't want to carry it around the theme park, or they don't really know. They're walking through the theme park and they see something they like, but then they think, well, maybe I'll see something better later. Yeah. And then they find something, and then later they wish they bought the thing, but it's on the other side of the park, you know, and they don't want to walk all the way back or take the tram. So it led to the idea that there should be an e-commerce store where people could order that merchandise. You don't only have to buy it. And it seems like an obvious idea, but it was not really naturally part of the way that the theme park industry thought.
Right.
So out of our research came this whole new business opportunity, which turned into an e-commerce store to buy all this merchandise. And that's now become a major source of revenue for that theme park, incremental, because again, and furthermore, customer convenience, because again, it didn't put the customer in the situation of, do I buy this giant stuffed animal and carry it around all day? Or do I run the risk that I won't be able to get it? Cause later I won't see it. You know, I was near the ET ride, right? They don't sell the ET stuffed animal on the other side of the park when you're at Back to the Future or whatever.
Okay. And is there some, is it a mindset change that's required for companies to become more customer centric, or what's involved in doing that?
Yeah. I do think it is a mindset change. And, you know, a lot of companies use this idea of being customer centric. It's like a buzzword, right? Oh, we're going to be customer centric. And the thing is, one of the things I talk about in the book is, what does it actually mean to be customer centric? Because all companies have customers,
and all customers say they're going to be. All companies say they're going to be customer centric. So, how do you measure that?
Yeah. Well, I think, like you say, I think it starts with mindset, and the mindset is, what is our priority in terms of how we adapt to meet a changing world? And, you know, if you're, and you know, one way I like to think about the idea of asking the question, "Are you customer centric?" is saying, "Well, what's the alternative?" Because all companies have customers. Nobody's arguing whether we should have customers, right? Like, that's never the conversation. Customers are good. I don't think anyone's taking the opposite argument in that debate. But the question is, are they the priority? And so one thing I like to point out is, okay, well, there are some alternatives. There are many businesses that are not customer-centric. So what are they? And I find they're either product-centric, or they're channel centric. So a product company would be a company like Kodak. Kodak was a film company, right? And as the world changed and everyone adapted digital cameras, what did Kodak say? Did they focus on digital cameras? I mean, they did a little bit, but not really, right? They didn't really, they invented the digital camera, but they didn't really go after that market because it didn't go with their sense of identity because they were a film company. And what do they do today? I mean, film. Right? There are still esoteric applications for film. And when you want film, they're the place to go. But obviously they rode that ride all the way to the bottom. So that, you know, versus a company like Apple that, you know, drops computer from their name because they realize that while they still sell computers, their computer business is eclipsed by phones and other things, software, and, you know, music. There was a time, I'm sure, at Apple where someone said, why are we creating a phone? We're a computer company. You know, this doesn't make sense. Motorola or Nokia, they're the leaders in phones, right? Remember those guys? Like, where are they now, right? And why is Apple, the computer company, creating a phone? So to your point about mindset, you have to be able to transcend that mindset that says, this is what our identity is as a company. And instead say, wait a minute, where is our customer going? We need to follow our customer there. And, you know, I think that's the key difference.
Okay. For customers who are, sorry, for companies who are, you know, thinking about starting out on this kind of journey, what should be their first steps?
I think the very first step is to get clear on what is your purpose as a company? Fundamentally, what are you there to do? And how does that transcend your existing product line or your existing experience? And, you know, it's the classic kind of business school example where, you know, Western Union wasn't interested in the telephone, right? Or the great rail lines didn't want to talk about air travel because they're like, we're a rail company, instead of seeing themselves as a transportation company, right? And everyone gets taught this stuff in business school, you know, but I think that's the first start, is to say, beyond literally what we do today, what is the mission that we have? What problems are we trying to solve for people? If you think of your purpose as a company, not in terms of your solutions, but in terms of the problem you solve, because, you know, not every company is trying to solve the same problems. One company is trying to educate America. Another company is trying to feed America. Another company is trying to keep them healthy. I mean, these are not the same thing, right? So it's not about doing everything. But if once you say, well, our job is to, you know, whatever, right? Keep people healthy or make people feel cool or happy or empower people with tools to unleash their creativity like Apple does. Once you understand what that is, then you have to ask yourself, well, what's stopping our customers, right? Why aren't they accomplishing that today? And that leads you to the problems. And then the problems, you know, typically lead you to the solution. So I think you start with understanding what's the fundamental problem space that your brand is focused on. And then it's what we talked about earlier. And then it's the customer research. We like to create what we call a pain map. Once we understand all those problems, to map out through all the stages of the buying life cycle, what are the challenges and obstacles that that customer faces? So if it's rental car, what are the challenges they face in deciding whether to rent a car, in reserving a rental car, in picking up a rental car, in using a rental car, in returning a rental car, right? And you could do this for any kind of experience or relationship. And once you're clear on all those problems, man, it's amazing how quickly it comes into focus, because the solutions then just become about, well, sometimes the solutions are obvious. Sometimes once you understand the problem clearly, it's not hard to come up with a solution. And other times, you know, you need research, you need technology to say, how could we apply? Is there a way to apply AI or machine learning or drones or virtual reality or whatever it is? But now you're applying a technology to solve a problem. Instead of what a lot of companies do is they say, well, here's a really cool technology. For sure, we should be using this. Now, what would be a problem we could solve with this? You know, that's like a doctor showing up at your door and saying, I've got this antibiotic. I need to find something wrong with you that I can use this antibiotic for. You know, maybe you need the antibiotic, but maybe not. Instead, you start with the diagnosis and then you figure out what's the intervention.
Okay. I mean, this is the Digital Supply Chain podcast. Is there anything specific to supply chain that you'd recommend to folks?
Well, absolutely. And you know, I know you and I have chatted out previously about like, what is supply chain, right? Yeah. And so some people historically think of supply chain as looking upstream to the suppliers of the raw materials or other services that you need in order to serve your customer. And others see the more comprehensive, I think SAP, but tell me if I'm right, sees the more comprehensive vision of the supply chain, which is all the way from raw materials to customer value, your customer's value.
Correct.
So I would say, let's look both directions. If I look upstream, if I say, well, you know, how can digital transformation impact those that supply my company with what I need to then deliver to my customer? I would say, well, first of all, we see many of the most successful companies, the companies that are creating the most value, creating the most rapid growth and valuation increase, are platform companies. And if you look at somebody like an Airbnb or an Uber or an Alibaba, they have a totally different approach to their supply, right? Instead of trying to purchase things and own them and transform them, they're creating a platform where suppliers and their customers can connect together. So it's the ultimate sort of frictionless, or nothing's truly frictionless, but lower friction supply. So that's one angle. But even if you're in a more traditional, let's say, manufacturing business, and you have still a non-transformed process where you have to find suppliers and you buy raw materials and maybe you make something, thinking about how you can be a preferred customer to those suppliers is potentially a huge competitive benefit. When you have a great relationship with those that are supplying whatever it is that you need, you're in a much better position to help them, to get them to innovate for you, to get them to customize for you, to give you differentiation, to get you them to provide you a prefer, you know, when certain raw materials may be in high demand, to get a larger percentage of the available supply. There's all kinds of reasons why looking upstream to your supply chain and thinking about the same exact question: what is their pain? What is the pain of the supplier of my raw materials? Because if I can be a better solver of that, obviously they want to sell them and make money, but everything from my payment terms to my ordering process to the way in which I make them look good by the way their product is used in my product are all opportunities. And there's many more to understand how you can be a better solution to their pain than maybe another customer. Compete for your suppliers. And then if you look in the other direction, if you look downstream and say, well, what about the other part of the supply chain? Of course, it goes to so much of what we just talked about. How can I create a better experience that makes my easier for my customer to find me, easier for my customer to understand why they should purchase my product, easier to purchase the product, more insight into the product is delivered, easier to get sale support on all of those components that make up the whole customer journey.
Yeah, I ran a couple of businesses back in the day, and I always used to say, make it easier for the customer to give you money, and that'll take away so many barriers. That'll make it so much easier to do business with them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's amazing how often we find usability problems on the checkout screen. And it's like, oh, geez, you know, just like you say, they're literally trying to give you money right now and they're encountering problems. I mean, this should be your number one business priority. Do not stop people when they're trying to give you money, for God's sakes.
Exactly. Exactly. Howard, we are coming up on the end of the podcast now. Is there anything I have not asked you that you wish I had, or any topics that we've not brought up that you think it's important for people to be aware of?
You know, one thing that I often talk about, and it goes, you know, there's a heart on the cover of my book, Winning Digital Customers, you know, and this idea that our emotional connection with our customers, and I would even, to the point you said about supply chain, I would even argue it goes back to our suppliers. I mentioned earlier that I believe so much of business is about driving behavior. And it begs the question, well, what really drives people's behavior? And the answer is thoughts and feelings, but more feelings than thoughts. You know, there are many studies that show that people tend to make decisions emotionally and then rationalize them intellectually. And so I think every business needs to be asking themselves, how can I be loved by my customer? If you look at those companies that are most successful today, those brands that everybody wishes they were, their customers love them.
Sure.
Now, not everybody loves them. Not everybody loves Google or Facebook or Amazon, but those aren't their customers, right? But their customers in large numbers love them. Apple, obviously, Disney. It's not only digital brands, right? And so how do you inspire that customer love? I think this is not a sufficiently talked about concept in the boardroom. Because when you have that level of customer love, that's an unbelievable asset. And so this is another thing that I go into in great depth in my book is, well, what do we mean by that? What is customer love? What are the components that inspire it? Because you can dissect it. It sounds a little clinical to say, well, let's take love and let's reverse engineer it. That's exactly what we've done, is to say, well, there are things that inspire and trigger love, and there are things that cause it to go away. And so how do you understand what those things are? in your customer. It has a lot to do with things like meeting their needs, delighting them, and resonating with what you stand for and having that seem relevant to the customer. And I know we're out of time, so I won't go into detail now, but really getting a clear strategy for what is your company doing to inspire customer love, and to the pain stuff we talked about earlier, what are the things that your company may be doing today that actually makes it difficult for your customers to love you? When you remove those barriers and start to put in the right signals that inspire that customer love, your business can absolutely explode. And there's so many, many case studies. And I've done many blog posts on this, and there's stuff in my book about it. So many case studies. And when you look at all the case studies, it becomes more obvious that this is so critical. And so part of my mission in the world in communicating is just to get people to think more about this idea of emotion and love as a hard-nosed business topic, because it really is.
Nice. Yeah, I know customer evangelists are the best evangelists.
Yes, right. Because they're genuine, right? Because yep. You see that you see that they have been moved. There's nothing more moving than somebody who has been moved versus, advertising. Look, people are so cynical about what companies say about themselves.
Yep.
It's the only value in advertising is to inspire doubt. I think this is the only value in advertising. Right. Doubt is at least recognition. If you tell people we're the friendliest airline on earth, what you're going to get is doubt. But at least people heard, yeah, these guys claim they're the friendliest airline on earth, which is one step better than I never heard of those guys. But then you still have a long way to go to convince them that you're the friendliest airline on earth. Just because you told them that, they don't believe you. They just know that you're somebody who is making a likely false claim. That's one little tiny step up from the bottom. And then you got a lot more distance to go. And that distance has to be largely bridged with a combination of customer experience and evangelism, because people do believe what they read in reviews and they do believe what other customers say.
Great. Howard, that's been fantastic. If people want to know more about yourself or about your book or about any of the topics we talked about on the podcast today, where would you have me direct them?
Of course. So if they want to learn more about my book, you can go to winningdigitalcustomers.com and you can actually download the first chapter of the book for free, buy the book at a special discount price, et cetera, et cetera. So would certainly want to encourage everyone to do that. If you'd like to learn more about my company, which is a design agency and consultancy called From Digital, you can get to us at from.digital, which is a real URL. You don't need the .com. Please tell your friends. And that's probably enough. But you can also find me on LinkedIn, Twitter, YouTube, and all the usual places by searching for me.
Spectacular. Howard, it's been great. Thanks a million for coming on the podcast today.
Oh, my pleasure. It's been a lot of fun, Tom.
Okay, we've come to the end of the show. Thanks everyone for listening. If you'd like to know more about digital supply chains, head on over to sap.com/digital supply chain or simply drop me an email to tom.raftery@sap.com. If you like the show, please don't forget to subscribe to it in your podcast application of choice to get new episodes as soon as they're published. Also, please don't forget to rate and review the podcast. It really does help new people to find the show. Thanks. Catch you all next time.